From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young in Boston.
I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. Forests are often called the lungs of the world. They absorb about a third of the carbon dioxide from fossil fuel burning. And today at the Climate Summit in Scotland, world leaders pledged to end deforestation in 9 years. And they signed on to cut 30% of the emissions of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas, from pipelines and farms. Here's President Biden.
This isn't just something we have to do to protect the environment and our future. It's an enormous opportunity for all of us, all of our nations, to create jobs and make meeting climate goals a core part of our global economic recovery as well.
NPR's Dan Charles is in Glasgow. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Scott.
Now, we focus a lot on CO2 as far as climate, but what's the significance of a big cut in methane emissions?
We should focus more on methane, probably. It's a very powerful greenhouse gas. It doesn't stay in the atmosphere as long, so that's one reason why people kind of don't focus on it as much. But the other way of looking at it is you get more bang for the buck by reducing methane emissions. You know, over, say, 20 years per pound of methane or pound of CO2, it's 80 times more heat trapping.
Wow.
And, you know, concentrations in the air have been rising. The feeling is this is a chance to do something quick.
Now, this has been a policy yo-yo here in the United States. As you know, President Trump rolled back some methane rules. President Biden is bringing them back. Methane leaks out from the transport and the storage of fossil fuels. How will the U.S., will the EPA enforce this?
It's a combination of things because it comes from different places, methane does. So in the case of the oil and gas industry, they're talking about regulations, expanding the existing regulations. In other places, like, you know, manure lagoons on hog farms or,
you know,
animal waste on dairies, they're talking about sort of financial incentives to get people to, you know, put the money into covering those lagoons, trapping the methane. So it's a bunch of different things.
Yeah. All right. Let's turn to this deforestation pledge, halting and reversing it in 9 years. Huge industries, ranching, growing soybeans and palm oil, have benefited from deforestation for decades. Previous pledges to try to do this, as you know, have not really succeeded. How hard is this going to be?
It's going to be very hard. And I think skepticism is real. You know, skepticism is warranted. Declarations have been made, you know, 2014, basically a bunch of countries promised to do the exact same thing, and it has not had the desired effect. On the other hand, this announcement includes $19 billion to, you know, sort of help make this happen. And in the meantime, since 2014, some new tools have been created to monitor deforestation, to try to get companies to, you know, sort of take action when they see their suppliers doing it. So it might be better this time. A lot of it just depends on enforcing existing laws in a lot of countries. And there is a new emphasis in this initiative in working with indigenous groups that live in and around and close to the forests. The feeling is they may be the best protectors of it.
Yeah. Now, another announcement from Glasgow is that the United States has rejoined a group called the High Ambition Coalition. It's chasing a more ambitious goal of keeping global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. The U.S. joining this group, significance, could this move the big needle of overall emissions cuts?
I'm a little skeptical that it means a whole lot. You know, the currency of these meetings is, you know, pledges. You know, in the way the Paris Agreement works, nations come in with their nationally determined contributions toward reaching this collective goal of, now it's kind of set, and everybody refers to this goal of 1.5 degrees Celsius. But it's kind of, you know, three layers removed from actually accomplishing that goal. You know, here at this big international meeting, nations come in and say, we commit to doing this. But that has to get translated into policies, which are kind of the tools. And the policies have to have the desired effect, you know, to convince some homeowner to switch their gas furnace out for a heat pump, or some developer to build multifamily buildings in an area that's well served by bus lines instead of more sprawl. You know, that requires people to get in their cars. It's, I don't know. We'll see how it all plays out.
Well, and if a country doesn't meet its promises, there's no real big hammer for, quote, failure, right?
Not on the country level. No, the country has to enforce, you know, these things through policies back home.
Yeah, and finally, Dan, do you expect any more significant ground to be broken at this summit?
You know, there. You mentioned, you know, the things we talked about, the methane and the deforestation, those were actually not products of the formal negotiation. They were just groups of nations getting together and saying, we're going to do this. I think there will be more of that in various areas. You know, in a way, the conference has already achieved its goal by being kind of a forcing event, you know, a deadline, forcing countries and companies to kind of bring something to this event and say, you know, this is our contribution to solving this problem.
All right. That is NPR's Dan Charles joining us from Glasgow, Scotland. Dan, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Well, to election beliefs this election day, while a majority of Americans believe Donald Trump lied about the 2020 election results because he didn't like the outcome, Republicans appear to have largely bought into those Trump lies about a stolen election and voter fraud of which there is no evidence. And most Republicans broadly don't trust U.S. elections, a troubling sign for U.S. democracy. These findings come from the latest NPR, PBS NewsHour, and Marist College poll. Lee Mieringoff is head of the Marist polling outfit, which conducted the survey. Lee, welcome.
Hey, my pleasure, Robin.
And tell us more about Republicans and trust in elections.
Well, I thought the findings of our partnership poll here were very interesting. Not only are there enormous differences between Democrats and Republicans, that's from the 20,000-foot angle, but when you drop down to about 5,000 feet, you find that Republicans are divided even among themselves as to whether they have a college education or not a college education. So let's take that one question you're talking about. Do you trust that elections are fair? Overall, 58% of the country says yes. Democrats are at 86%, Republicans at 34%. And there's a 19-point difference within Republicans as to whether they have a college education or not. So we're talking about very, very different segments of the American population here.
Well, and are you saying that those who have less of an education, fewer years spent in education, may be more prone to not trust the elections?
Yeah, I think there's, you know, serious doubts. And those have been fed by Donald Trump, certainly going into the election, but definitely since. And we see that, you know, his message that the election was rigged. Democrats and Republicans have a very different view on that.
Yeah.
Again, 62% overall say it's just because he didn't like the outcome. 34% say there was evidence of fraud, even though there hasn't been. 75% of Republicans say that the election was rigged and there is evidence of fraud. Mm-hmm. So the parties, again, are very divided, and again, along educational lines within the Republicans.
Did you ask directly, did this information come from the president, or where they got this information?
No, we didn't trace that as much as just whether they agreed with President Trump that the election was rigged or not. And that's that was the indication that people said. And I think that, you know, again, what is the cause of this? The Democrats feel it's suppression. The Republicans think it's fraud.
Yeah.
The country is incredibly divided from the 2020 election. There's some greater confidence going into 2022. But then if you ask people about the next presidential election, their confidence, again, deteriorates. And Republicans are very doubtful that the 2024 presidential election is going to be much better than the one in 2020, which they do not agree with the outcome.
So a real serious
threat to the democracy, because winners and losers and declaring victory and conceding defeat are really principal bedrock principles of our democracy, and right now they're really under challenge.
I'm going to draw an even finer line under that. So you're saying the seeds are already planted for distrust, at least in a powerful minority, a distrust of the 2024 elections. And we saw what happened after the 2020 elections, when there was that distrust in the outcome of an election that led right to an insurrection at the Capitol. So, yes, that's disturbing. You also asked about Trump and sitting President Biden as potential 2024 candidates. What do you hear in the minute we have?
Yeah, I think that today is obviously a very important day for Joe Biden. You know, it's the first election nationally, or at least in two key states, New Jersey and Virginia. Biden's approval rating has ebbed downwards to 44% nationally. But I think troubling for him is that 37% strongly disapprove, only 15% strongly approve of him. So there's more dislike than like there. And Democrats are saying, well, you know, maybe we should have someone else at the head of the ticket. We might do better. Republicans, they're comfortable with Donald Trump being their standard bearer in 2024.
Lee Meringhoff, head of the Marist polling outfit, thanks so much for sharing your findings. We'll post them at hearnow.org. America's national parks are grappling with climate change and resulting extreme weather this year. In Denali, a landslide. In Sequoia, forest fires. And in Maine's Acadia National Park, a flash flood earlier this year has put a section of trail at risk of closing for good. Reporter Carly Peruccio has the story.
On June 9th, Gary Stubflug got an unusual radio call.
He said, "Hey, Gary, your bridge is washed downstream."
Stubflug is Acadia National Park's trail foreman. He and his team maintain Acadia's hiking trails. So Stubflug went to the site of the radio call.
The Maple Springs Trail, sections of it, were just gone.
That's where we're standing now.
Totally disappeared.
The Maple Spring Trail runs next to a stream in a narrow gorge through forests that were indigenous Wapanaki hunting and gathering areas. On one end of this storm-battered section is a gravel carriage road. On the other end is a 1,000-foot mountain. And in between them is unrecognizable.
So that's quite a sizable chunk of granite that was knocked off its pedestal and landed on our bridge. And then there's a, 60-foot ash tree in front of us, and its roots are just torn out from underneath it.
The problem was that a lot of rain fell in a really short time. Park headquarters registered about 4 inches of rain overnight. Almost 1 inch fell in just 15 minutes from 3 a.m. to 3:15. In a press release, Acadia called this one of the most extreme weather events in its history. The intense rain damaged some other hiking trails and carriage roads, but Maple Spring is the only one that's still closed to the public. And Stubflug knows this trail well. He got his first job in Acadia in the 70s. Over the years, he and his trail crew have repaired century-old stone steps and a wooden footbridge that park visitors have used to walk through this gorge, along this stream. Beyond the obvious signs of storm damage, Stubflug can see where boulders had been but are gone now. He notices where granite stones aren't hunter green anymore, they're pink because the rain scoured the moss away.
It's a piece of like 45 years of my life is just gone.
The extent of the damage leaves Acadia with a difficult decision. Restoring the trail with brand new stepping stones and stone walls could cost over $1 million, only for another extreme rainstorm to come along.
Our rain events are higher volumes of water in shorter periods of time. This is not a one-off anymore.
That's Keith Johnston, the head of Acadia's maintenance division.
Put it back and lose it again in a few years, that's hard to justify the expense.
Acadia has other options, like repairing some parts of the trail, or even opening it up as is. They could move the trail out of the gorge onto a hillside where there's less risk of flooding. They're even considering closing it forever and deleting it from trail maps. Acadia National Park isn't alone in having to make hard decisions and accept hard losses. Maple Spring is a half-mile trail in a park system of over 85 million acres.
No, it's not the Library of Alexandria. But
even if his team rebuilds it, Gary Stubflug says it won't be the same. For NPR News, I'm Carly Peruccio in Maine.
Online dating apps. 3 out of 10 adults in this country say they use them, hoping for a meaningful connection. But beware, the lovey-dovey on the other end may be a scammer. In the last 3 years, people say they have lost more money to romance scams than any other fraud. That's according to the Federal Trade Commission. And during pandemic 2020, reported losses hit a new high of $304 million. For more, let's bring in Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. She wrote about this in her column recently. Michelle, welcome back.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, love to have you. So help us understand this. I mean, play out one of these scams to illustrate how this works.
So what will happen is someone will set up a profile on one of the dating apps looking for love. This is the victim, I mean. Mm. Or they might find themselves on Facebook or LinkedIn and they get a friend request or, you know, a connection request and they start up a conversation and it becomes romantically like. But what they don't know on the other side of that is a scammer. Most likely someone who's actually international. Hmm. And then the request starts coming in for money for all kinds of stuff, you know, and then they end up being scammed.
Yeah. Now, this has happened. And of course, the pandemic numbers are sky high for reported losses here. I mean, how has the pandemic made this worse? I guess we're all used to distance everything, distance romance and distance romance scams, you know.
That's right.
A big part of
That's
the pandemic,
right.
I guess.
Yeah, well, the pandemic pushed quite a few more people online that weren't already online. This is particularly true for older adults, you know, 60 or over. And, you know, people are lonely. And they also particularly target widows and widowers or divorced older adults because they know they're looking for, you know, a connection. As you get older, your kids move out, you get, you know, distance in different states and you're not as close to your friends and family. And they know that and they prey on these folks, particularly older adults who they assume, you know, have more money because they might have retirement savings and so forth. And when it comes to older adults, 60 and older, they in 2020 lost $139 million to romance scams.
Wow.
That's up from $84 million in 2019. And that's only what people reported. So it could be millions more.
Well, and that's my question for you is this has to be a conservative number because right, so many people... It's embarrassing. They don't want to go public and say this happened to me.
Yeah, they don't want to go public. And they don't also tell their family members. Read a story in on the AARP website where this woman, you know, she was connected to someone, was at a hotel waiting to meet this person, and they never showed up. And she gave them thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Oh,
and that's
goodness.
The other thing about the pandemic. So they don't want to meet you, clearly, because they're not real. And so they would make up all kinds of excuses, but the pandemic allowed them to make up a very plausible excuse. I can't travel because of the pandemic. Oh, my gosh, I got a COVID-19. You know, I've got COVID, so I can't come meet you. And it just made it sound so reasonable because, you know, there's all this distance now because of the pandemic.
Now, for these victims, it's easy to mock them and blame them as gullible, but there's a sophistication here, right? I mean, some of these are international professionals, as it were.
That's right. You know, I talked to an official at the Federal Trade Commission, and what I thought was so interesting was like, listen, this is not somebody in some mom's basement. This is crime syndicates in boiler rooms, and they train them to say the right things, to get people to send them money.
Okay, so what can we do to protect ourselves and our loved ones from these scammers?
If the victims aren't going to come forward, we as the people who love these people who are looking for love need to just say, hey, what's going on in your life? Who are you talking to? And then, you know, if they say they're online talking to someone, do a reverse image search. Just make sure that person is legitimate. Like, hey, I heard about this catfishing, these scammers. Why don't we just check this out just to be sure? And the most important thing, and there might be people listening, if someone you have not met in person, and look, I don't even want to send money to my own relative. But if someone you haven't met asks you for money, I don't care if it's $10, that is a scam. I mean, it just Adopt that as a rule, and you will be less likely to be victimized.
Michelle, you mentioned that these are criminal syndicates. What do we know about their tactics?
You know, there were a couple of reports out of the Justice Department recently where they looked at this, and they often are groups of men. They collect these scammers, and they train them to call these people. And these scams can go on for weeks or months. That's how much time they put in it. In Texas, 11 suspects were charged with targeting widowed and divorced seniors on dating sites such as like Match.com or Christian Mingle. And if I can just add this in, if they ask you to jump off of these apps to something else, that's another red flag that's a scam. They want to email you directly or, you know, and then you still don't meet them. These are huge red flags. And never, never pay anybody with gift cards or wire transfer. Just adopt the blanket rule that if they ask you to send money through a gift card or wire transfer, it is a scam.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're a financial columnist, and there are these numbers, these dollar figure numbers of losses, but this is also an emotional loss.
That's right.
For these victims.
That's right. You know, they lose, and especially when it comes to older victims, they're losing their financial security, but they're also losing their heart. And it's hard to come back from that. I talked to someone, an expert at the Fraud Watch Network at the AARP, and they talked about some victims actually even committing suicide.
Oh, my goodness.
Because they lost so much of their money and they were so embarrassed. And that just makes me incredibly sad.
Yeah, reality of our time. That's Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Michelle, great to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Today is Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead. It's a traditional Mexican holiday when people pay tribute to those they have lost. Last year, people did not gather in public for this, for obvious reasons. But now, even as COVID casualties rise, the observance is returning to normal. Here now's Chris Bentley reports on how some in Chicago are marking the occasion.
Isabel Hernandez loves decorating her garden for the holidays. And this year, she's gone all out for Day of the Dead. Using 178 milk crates donated by a food pantry down the street, she built a 15-foot-tall altar in the shape of a pyramid. Hernandez reached out to her neighbors for photos of loved ones they've lost. More than 200 people responded.
I'm a person that always have to give back, and this is my way to pay tribute to the community.
Her community, like so many around the world, has been hit hard by the pandemic. Hernandez's brother Ruben died from COVID in January. His photo is at the top of the pyramid with the rest of the family members she's honoring this year.
When you see the face of the loved ones along with other people's faces, you see you're not alone. It's not the same, you know, that a lot of people die, but when you see them all together, it's not so sad, so suffering.
She has another altar inside where she'll pay tribute to her grandparents by leaving an offering of their favorite foods, enchiladas and stuffed peppers. Neighbors have been streaming through to see the altar, a welcome change from last year when lockdown measures and the lack of a vaccine meant most people kept their Day of the Dead celebrations small. That was the case at the nearby National Museum of Mexican Art, which went virtual. This year, they're open again, and mask-wearing crowds are filing through to see Day of the Dead art installations from both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border. Curator Cesario Moreno says the break has given visitors a new perspective.
People are walking in after having spent the last 2 years living closer to death, experiencing death all around. And I think people are coming in this time and really understanding the exhibition in a different way, probably more the way in which it's intended to be back in Mexico.
It's a solemn time, but also an occasion to share joyful memories of loved ones.
And by telling their stories, we include them in the family. In Mexico, we know that one day they're going to be talking about us and telling our stories and saying our names. And so there's something peaceful about it and normal, where life and death are seen as one and not in opposition to each other.
That sentiment is on full display at a festival behind the museum on Saturday night. Argelia Gonzalez is remembering her father, a competitive cyclist, who died of cancer last year.
His name was Edilberto Gonzalez. El siempre guapo Edilberto Gonzalez is what they called him. Always good looking, always handsome. That was his nickname when he was a cyclist.
Gonzalez has draped a garland of marigolds around the altar, which is full of pictures of her father.
It's really special, especially because this is our first time setting one up, and it's for my dad. Every year we see that it grows.
She says it's good to be able to remember her father this way, surrounded by her friends and neighbors once again. For Here and Now, I'm Chris Bentley.
During the two-week global meeting on climate, we're also exploring global warming. Sometimes the impacts really hit home when they, well, hit your home. People in California seeing fiery red clouds or flooding in Louisiana, in subways in New York. But what if you're not yet seeing that drama firsthand? A new website, This Climate Does Not Exist, can make climate change exist right on your doorstep, virtually. Sasha Lucioni is a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Montreal, lead researcher on this project from the Mila Institute. Sasha, welcome.
Nice to be here.
Well, you know, I went on the website. We'll talk more about going on it, but how does it work? I mean, I see you type in your address, the place that you want to see what climate change would look like. You can pick up a filter of smog, fire, or flooding. But you're not just doctoring a photo. You're not just taking a photo and pasting it over the house. What are you doing?
So it's actually, we're using an algorithm, so like a computational approach that can actually generate new content. So it can be used to generate deep fakes, for example. It's the same mm-hmm. approach. What it does is it takes the input image and it will try to find the elements on the image, so cars, buildings, etc. And essentially, it'll create a 3D representation of the image in its memory. And then it will project the water on the image in a way that's as realistic as possible. Mm-hmm. And the way we trained it is we essentially gave it a bunch of images of normal street scenes, normal places, and then places hit by climate change. So as you mentioned, New York, Australia, I mean, there's been flooding pretty much all over the planet in the last 2 years. So essentially, we trained it in order to learn how to generate these images.
Yeah. Well, and in my case, when I did it, I did it with my house, and you could see, bushes sticking up through the water. It wasn't just a Photoshop with water put over everything. You could see, it looked very real, and it was going up the front steps of my porch, and it was horrifying, frankly, because that's when I remembered, the back of the house, that's a basement apartment. That would be underwater.
There was a lot of cases of this during the recent New York floods, actually.
Yeah. And what did you see? What was it like for you?
Well, I've searched a lot of addresses. I think, I don't know why, but what really hits home for me are landmarks, places I've been and that have stayed with me, things like Times Square or the Triumphal Arch in Paris. So really places you go and that are like beautiful and historical and, that really kind of stay in your memory. And then when you see them, for example, flooded or surrounded by wildfire smoke, you're like, what? This like society has created these places. Like Notre Dame is, 500 years old and they can really go up in flames. Literally.
And talk about some of the concerns you and so many of us have about the amount of time we have left to really address this. I mean, I'm imagining that was behind doing this.
Yeah, at first we were like, well, we were a bit skeptical because we didn't think it would make an impact, honestly, because, you know, people see images of climate change quite regularly. I think we've become a bit blasé because, you know, you hear about this almost all the time. But I think that when we realized that seeing your own house or places that you really care about really carries a different message than just seeing somebody else's place.
Yeah, you know, and I'm thinking of the recent stories. The flooding in China, people in subway cars, you know, on cell phones to their loved ones as the water rose. And it's horrifying, but doesn't seem to move the needle. So you're saying you think that seeing your own subway system maybe or your own home or a grandparent's home might. And I just want to ask you personally, because I know you worked in AI in the corporate world. Why the switch?
Well, yeah, I was working and really enjoying my job, actually. It was really interesting to solve all these puzzles and make lots of money. But then I realized that there was something missing for me and that I had children at the time and my two young daughters essentially were born while I was working there. And then I realized that I wanted to look them in the eye 10 years later and say, you know, I did my utmost to make sure that you have a planet where you can thrive and be healthy. And I realized that maybe, you know, solving just interesting puzzles wasn't going to cut it. Initially, I was going to quit my job and go volunteer or you know, clean up forests, pick up trash, things like that. And then my partner said, well, maybe you can use what you've acquired, your skills in AI, to fight climate change. Maybe you don't need to start from scratch.
Now you've switched to climate change. And on the website, this climate does not exist. By the way, what's the meaning of that title?
So there was this trend a couple of years ago when the generative adversarial networks first came out, training them on a bunch of images of something and then saying, well, for example, this person does not exist. And then there was they were really realistic images of people. And then that became a website. And then there was like, this cat does not exist. This apartment does not exist. Mm-hmm. There's actually a website called This X Does Not Exist. And it has like, I don't know, tens of these different websites that actually use these networks to generate kind of, well, I guess people call them deep fakes.
Oh, deep fakes, because it's artificial.
Yeah, they call them deep fakes, but Essentially it's not like photoshopping. It's more like generating from scratch. It's really like based on all of these portraits, headshots of people, you can generate a new person. We wanted to kind of play on that trend, but also we really wanted it to be clear that we're not saying that this is true. We're not saying your house is going to be underwater. We're saying that this climate does not exist. It doesn't. It's not real. But unless we take action soon, it will. And the thing is, there's a gap between when we can take action, when we actually have a chance of you know, stopping global warming at a decent degree, and these consequences. So when this climate will exist, it'll be too late.
Well, and it does exist, as you said, for so many people. And at the website as well, and we'll link everybody up at herenow.org. But and by the way, are people saying, what can I do after they see it? How are people reacting? And then what can they do?
So we proposed a number of actions, both individuals, what people can do specifically, but actually what we found while doing all this research is that the most single impactful thing that people can do is talk about climate change and talk about it to their friends, to their, I don't know, to their colleagues, to their neighbors, because, you know, this should become a global phenomenon, right? Like a collective phenomenon. And the more we talk about it, it becomes more, you know, socially acceptable and more on people's minds when they make these choices. So it should kind of always be in the back of our heads when either, I don't know, we're choosing whether we take the train or fly, and then choosing our dinner and, you know, doing this and that. It should always kind of be in the back of our mind and influencing our choices. And that's what it's going to take. It's going to take a billion of small choices in order to make one big change.
Well, you talk about those little things people can do, and you've come up with tools for computer engineers to lessen their carbon footprint. How so?
Yeah, this was actually something that I've been working on. What I realized is that we don't have very good tools of figuring out our carbon footprint when it comes to computing, because, you know, you have all these carbon footprint calculators when you can enter how many miles you drive and what kind of food you eat. But the computing that we do, the actual training of AI models and things like that, also has a carbon footprint. So we developed a tool called Code Carbon, which essentially is like a small computer program that runs in parallel to whatever other code you're running. At the end, we'll print out an estimate of how much carbon you emitted. So that's going to be based on how long you were computing for, what energy source you were using, what hardware you were using, et cetera, et cetera. So it's going to take all these different parameters and essentially give you a number, and then you can compare it to like number, quantity of, you know, miles driven in a car and things like that to give you an idea of, you know, the order of magnitude.
Huh. So meanwhile, we've got COP26, a huge meeting on climate change in Glasgow. What are you looking for?
So, I mean, we would love to get images created by our algorithm up there because, you know, as they say, a picture is worth 1,000 words. And I feel like there's so many numbers and so much kind of dense information that's out there about climate change. But as people, we also respond really well to images. Getting those images out there and, you know, I guess kind of high level, but you know, if they're talking about 4.5 degrees of warming, you have an image of the Eiffel Tower flooded, things yeah. like that would be really yeah. great because, you know, what does 4.5 degrees mean? Well, it means different things for different people and for different countries. So I think putting an image to these numbers could be very impactful to actually triggering change, because that's the issue. These COPs happen and people talk about it and they debate and then not much gets done in the long run. So I'm hoping that images can kind of be a game changer in that sense.
There is no more long run. Sasha Lucioni, postdoctoral researcher at the University of Montreal, lead researcher on the new climate visualization project from the Mila Institute. It's called This Climate Does Not Exist. You make it exist when you go online. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. Sasha, thank you and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
So let's play word association. I say renewable energy, and you say, wait, fossil fuel companies? Well, in the case of offshore wind, that's right. Shell and BP and others are among the biggest developers of wind farms on the water. After all, they do know how to manage large projects offshore. Miriam Wasser of member station WBUR looks at big oil getting into big offshore wind.
David Marty is a straight-laced kind of a guy. He's also a numbers guy and spent much of his career at Royal Dutch Shell helping the company plan big oil and gas projects around the world.
There's the complexity to it, so it's like a big jigsaw puzzle.
But last year, he decided to try something new. Marty now works as a project manager for Mayflower Wind, a joint venture of Shell and two European utilities. He says his work helping to plan a commercial-scale offshore wind farm near Nantucket, Massachusetts, is very similar to what he previously did on oil and gas drilling projects. What's actually surprised him the most about his new job was the reaction of his two teenage daughters. They don't usually care about what he's working on.
But when I mentioned offshore wind, their feedback was, wow, really excited to see you get into this, Dad. Man, this is great. Really, you know, wow, way to go.
Marty's daughters care a lot about climate change. The question is whether his bosses at Shell do too.
Electricity from wind power will bring us to a cleaner and more sustainable future.
Shell's ads might make you think the company is dumping fossil fuels.
The energy system must change faster. And change is opportunity. Shell is acting today to be part of this future.
But consider these numbers. Shell is spending $16 billion on fossil fuels this year, and only $2 to $3 billion on low-carbon investments, which include offshore wind. Or take the case of BP. For a while, it rebranded as Beyond Petroleum and dallied in solar before giving that up. They're now dipping a toe in wind and solar again. Of the $12 billion it spent last year, 6% went to renewables.
They try to present themselves as the solvers of climate change and not as the creators of climate change.
Mary Ananise Hegler is a writer and co-host of the popular environmental podcast Hot Take. She says fossil fuel companies are infamous for greenwashing, trying to make themselves look more environmentally friendly than they are.
The people who got us into this mess willfully don't deserve any sort of driving position to where we go next. So I don't understand how they can be trusted with wind energy.
Of course, not all oil and gas companies are the same, says Pasha Madavi. Madavi is a political science professor at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He published a study recently looking at whether any of the largest privately held oil and gas companies were actually making good on their promises to go green.
So far, the record has largely been one of either hedging or greenwashing. And almost nobody is trying to actually transition because they hadn't believed in a real transition.
Madavi found zero examples of oil companies that are fully embracing renewable energy and several U.S.-based companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron that are actively resisting changes to the status quo. But he also found a few companies in the middle, the so-called hedgers, Shell, BP, Equinor. They're investing modest amounts of monies into renewables, including offshore wind.
We've seen oil companies trying to pivot because the writing is starting to be written on the wall. I mean, it's been written on the wall. They're just starting to see it.
But will the oil companies be any good at offshore wind? Of all the renewable energy options, experts say offshore wind probably has the greatest overlap with the work oil companies already do. Most obvious, the big construction projects in the ocean. David Marty, the Shell employee now at Mayflower, says oil companies have a lot of experience with complicated and expensive projects. Just one of the boats needed to install a wind turbine costs $500,000 a day to rent. So you need to be very careful in how you draw up contracts and plan for bad weather.
Because, you know, $500,000 a day, you want to get that more right than wrong. And oil and gas companies have quite a bit of experience in trying to get that right.
Not everyone agrees this experience will translate to offshore wind.
No matter what they say, what they are good at, what they have specialized in is digging up, extracting, burning, transporting fossil fuels.
Justin Gui is the director of global climate strategy for the Sunrise Project, a nonprofit committed to ending the use of fossil fuels. He says oil companies might be able to help jumpstart the offshore wind industry in the U.S., but he's skeptical that they're committed to building it to the size and scale many hope for. That's because going all in on offshore wind would mean abandoning the business that made them rich.
We didn't go to Blockbuster and say, you know movies, you bring us into the streaming digital age. So to me, it's a really bizarre conversation because we have very little evidence of legacy incumbents disrupting themselves and destroying their own legacy markets. And yet that's basically what the oil majors are telling us they will do.
Environmentalists say oil companies should still be held accountable for their role in climate change, and they'd like to see more players in offshore wind. But in the short term, we face a climate crisis, and time matters. Deborah Gordon leads the Oil and Gas Solutions Initiative at the nonprofit Rocky Mountain Institute.
We need to transform and transform really quickly. And I think if we write off anyone, especially anyone who has deep pockets, then we will slow progress.
Gordon says we don't have the luxury to be choosy about who can provide solutions. So if the oil companies can help launch an offshore wind industry in the U.S., she says it's a risk worth taking. For Here and Now, I'm Miriam Wasser.
That story was co-reported with Ben Starrow of E&E News. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It is Here and Now.